Hello, hello, and hello again. I'm Brother Francisco. Joining with me is my brother, Nate Whitaker.
What's up?
Hello. Welcome back to All Good in the Brotherhood podcast, the podcast of the Benedict Project, which is, if you don't know, an initiative to revitalize the culture in the spirit of St. Benedict. So, pretty cool. And one of the ways to revitalize culture is to allow us to return back to real logic and thinking and the exploration of things that are transcendent, asking the hard questions, having maybe heady conversations. We kind of run away from headiness a lot. And even in seminary, sometimes we're told like, well, your homilies can't be like too heady because, you know, these people might not know.
And there's told that in your formation?
Well, I've been, not across the board. There's been a few people who have articulated that. And they're not entirely wrong because there are people who
will get turned off by that.
Yeah.
To be all things, all people, right?
But on the other hand, there are people who are interested and feel more engaged when you're kind of challenging the intellect.
Yeah.
So,
and same way you can have, this is the issue that we saw with Albert Einstein, right? When Albert Einstein was a little kid, he did badly in school because he wanted deep things. He was already a genius when he was a kid, but his teachers were showing him very elementary, simple things. And so he wasn't able to focus, and he actually did very badly in school. I think sometimes a similar thing can happen in the faith when there are people who are fascinated with theology or they have some deep questions and they recognize that they have them, but then they go to mass or they hear a very simplistic homily and they feel that their needs for theological engagement aren't being met. Mm-hmm. So then if there's somebody who does understand that the church has a lot of answers, if they believe that, then they're going to feel dissatisfied, but at least they might know where to turn. They can go do their own research. But what's even worse is for many people, they might have these deep answers, or so they might have these deep questions, philosophical questions or theological questions, but they're not quite sure whether or not the church even has answers because they haven't heard them in their own experience. So they might question whether or not there are these answers. Mm-hmm. And so their conclusion is, okay, I guess this church is just a bunch of people singing about Jesus and trying to have good feelings and there's no depth here.
Yeah.
And then they might just leave the church. So I think, honestly, that's what we've seen. We've seen massive drop and decline in numbers of the faithful since, say, the 1960s or 1970s. Many people have stopped going to church. There are an increasing number of what we call the nuns, people that don't go to church anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's directly related to the fact that since the 60s or 70s, there's also less depth of catechesis in how we approach teaching the faithful. You know, there's less focus on theology, less focus on solid doctrine and philosophy. So I think meeting those needs, presenting the answers that our faith has to offer, is a good way of engaging people and meeting those needs. So.
Yeah, and to show that there is such a depth of beauty and understanding in the church. I mean, the more I study like stuff like canon law or Christology, whatever it is, I just realize the church has spent so much time and so much energy questioning and answering these questions, but we barely ever offer people the fruit of the church's investigations.
We barely even scratch the surface. Yeah.
Yeah. So, actually, recently, I forget who it was. I think it was the rector. I was talking to him, and he said that in a recent poll of, I guess, thousands and thousands of Christians, whatever, Catholic priests ranked as the most boring homilists or the most boring.
Wow.
They have the most boring sermons out of any denomination.
That's crazy. Out of any denomination. Okay.
Hey, which is pretty telling.
Your job is to change that. Change that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what we're trying to do. So we can maybe try to do something like that today. We spent a little time back in the philosophical realm. It's been a little while since we've done some philosophy. That's actually how this podcast really started, was to really explore philosophy and kind of break through the ice for people who see philosophy as maybe a daunting or, on the other side, completely undesirable field to explore. So I thought we could maybe, in 40 minutes, tackle a small aspect of maybe a word that daunts people or it sounds foreign or crazy to them, which is metaphysics. So what is metaphysics, Nate?
Well, metaphysics, the name just comes from the Greek word for above nature or beyond nature. So you have meta, above or beyond, and then physica, which, you know, is the word for nature. So some studies of philosophy focus on natural things, natural bodies. For example, the elements and the things that mm-hmm. we encounter on a physical reality and in our material experience, and including ourselves, our bodies, and even natural forms. So those are things that are a lot more experiential and a posteriori. But there's also another realm of philosophy that focuses on the metaphysics. So that is things that transcend our experience. They transcend physical reality. These are things like being considered in itself. So that might sound like a very intimidating phrase.
Yeah.
But we recognize we use the word to be. We use that verb. We use the noun being to refer to this or that person. It's not very common that we use that term on mm-hmm. ordinary speech, except when we're talking about philosophy. But we do use the term like human being. So we acknowledge there's such a thing as a being. Well, metaphysics is basically just the study of being considered in itself. It's being as yeah. being.
Being insofar that it is being.
Exactly. So there's other realms where we might consider a being with regard to some certain quality something. Yeah. Right? So in some area of science, we might be considering the quantity of being, like that'd be mathematics, right? Or other things, we might study the qualities of certain beings. But in metaphysics, we're really just focusing on the being for its own sake.
Which is, you know, we say like, whoa, that's super meta. When we're still like, yeah. That's, you know, it really is beyond. And it's such a foreign question. And probably most people would never even cross their minds as something to think about. I'm going to think about being insofar as it is being itself.
Yeah.
And, but the reality is that if we study all of the other things, right, you know, whether it's biological, chemical, emotional, psychological, in a sense, they all have the one thing in common, that they are, that they exist. Even if their existence is a little bit more mental existence, you know, we have ideas. Ideas don't exist in the same way that, you know, we kind of exist, right? We walk around, we have move and being, but they have a being in my mind. They have a reality in thought. Yeah. So there is some sense in which all of these things are studied, though wildly different, all yeah. share that one commonality of being. But what is it then?
Yeah.
Is it all the same? Mm-hmm. Is it really simple? Is it really difficult to understand? Is it complex? Is it not? And is it equal across the board for all the things that we talk about?
In a way, it's simple and simpler than those other categories of thought or science. But in another way, it's very abstract. Because I think by example or by analogy to this question of being, you could picture the study of a human person. So there's a lot of ways you could look at a human person. You could consider their weight, their height, their mm-hmm. looks. You can consider their bodily functions. Like, what does it mean to live like a human? What does it mean to walk like a human? What is the digestive system of a human work like? You could do all those things that are basically analyzing little aspects of a human person. But then you mm-hmm. might also make up some philosophy or some focus of science where you're just devoted to focusing, what does it mean to be a human person? What is a human person
right.
at its yeah. core? Not in its physical qualities, but at its core, in its essence. That's kind of analogous to what you're doing with metaphysics, where instead of saying, all right, we're going to consider rocks or fire or water, or we're going to consider these animals or plants and consider how their organs work or how their functions are or any of their qualities or quantities, instead of focusing on all those what you call accidents,
mm-hmm.
we're going to focus on essence and being considered for its own sake, like I was saying a minute ago. So yeah, in a way it's simple because that is a much simpler thing. It's less complex in the sense of it's less multitudinous, but in another way, it's very abstract. It's not something that we're physically acquainted with.
Yeah. And it is the highest level of abstraction that we make yeah. in philosophy.
Right.
The lowest is something in nature. And then it, you know, goes higher to ideas, whether it's epistemology or mathematics. And then we get metaphysics. So if it sounds crazy, it is kind of crazy to think about. But it is really important.
It's because, not useless.
Yeah, it's not. And in fact, a lot of the issues, at least my conclusion is, a lot of the issues that we are dealing with in the culture, particularly related to identity and the human person, stem both from a misunderstanding of human anthropology, but also an even more fundamental misunderstanding of the nature conclusions that we get about people based in metaphysics.
Yep.
So
Real quick,
go ahead. Yep.
I think a lot of our misunderstandings about God and theology spring from fundamental
100%.
misconceptions about metaphysics. Because even traditionally, in the scholastic tradition of our faith, it was believed you should study metaphysics before you really advance to theology. So you should already have an understanding of being considered in itself before you start considering the things of God.
Yep.
And I think somewhere along the line, because we just decided as a general culture that metaphysics is too abstract and too hard for most people, and we didn't really give people the benefit of the doubt and assume that they would be wise enough to come to some understanding, or that they just don't have time. Because of that, we kind of abandoned the study of metaphysics. And so when we approach catechesis or theology, we kind of just dive into it head first without the grounding that we're supposed to have, which is a good understanding of metaphysics. And in some way, that's understandable, because not everybody has time to go into some deep philosophy. But it can lead to some issues down the road when you start getting to some discussions of God or understanding how God works or understanding how the faith works. But you lack these kind of fundamental concepts that you get from metaphysics. So before we're kind of talking about metaphysics a bunch, but before we dive into it, it is important to point out that this is not just useless jargon.
Yeah.
It actually
is
helpful, especially for our faith.
Mm-hmm. So now that we've talked about it, let's talk of it a little bit more. So also just, full disclosure, or I don't know, what do you want to say? This was an entire class.
for both of us.
Yeah. So if you're like, oh, I didn't really get it, I don't get enough, we had months to tackle this stuff, and we still don't really know that much. Yeah. But there is the first dense stuff. Yeah, it's very dense. But the first and fundamental thing to consider, and this is what we're going to kind of talk about today, or even just open your mind to even consider some of these questions, is that first basic principle of what is metaphysics? What is being? Studying being as being. And is it all the same? What is a being versus to have being or to be? Because those are actually all three different things.
Right.
So let's tackle some of these things, Nate. All right. Lay out for us, and it was also can be helpful, in our English language falls short, to be pulling in some of the ancients, whether it's Latin or Greek, that helps to distinguish some of these things from each other. So let's just see where we go. So take it away. Being, a being, having being.
Yeah. Well, our boy Hamlet says to be or not to be.
So we know
that being is a verb. We know that you say, when you say I am, you are, he, she, it is, that verb that you're talking about is the verb to be, right? So we know that it can be a verb. So it's an action. It's an activity.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, we also know that being can refer to a noun. It can refer to a thing, because you say a human being and you're not referring to an activity. You're referring to a person, a thing. So that itself presents something kind of complicated, because you say, all right, well, in some sense, we use the word be to refer to an action, and another way, refer to it as a thing. And that, you might say that's just a failing on the part of English. But regardless, it's the situation we're presented with. So what Latin gives us, we have from the philosophical tradition, especially Aristotle refers to this, but Thomas Aquinas dives into it a lot in his commentary on the Metaphysics, is distinction between being as an action versus being as a thing. So the verb to be, the action, I am a man, you are a man, that verb, that in Latin is the verb esse, to be. Now, esse, we don't need to get into Latin verbs, how they work. Yeah. But the point is, it's a verb. That's an activity.
Yeah.
Then for a being as a thing, like a human being, that is the word ens. That is a Latin word for ens. So now the thing is, there's a third thing you kind of need to consider when you're talking about this, which is the word essentia in Latin. So for us, we translate that as just essence. So an essence is a nature, or it's a form. So you and I, for example, here's why we need to distinguish essence. You and I have two different activities of being.
Yes.
You exist and I exist, and we have separate existences, so that if you die, I'm still going to keep living.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be sad, but I'd get over it. You to be and I to be, those are two different things. But we do share some mode of being, which we'd call our essence or our nature, because you are a human and I'm a human. And that separates us from the way cats exist or the way dogs exist, because they might also exist right now at this very moment, but we know they have a different species. They have a different nature, form, or again, to use the word that I introduced, they have a different essentia. So basically, if you want to do basic metaphysics math, if you take an essentia, a form, a nature, and you give it finite existence with the verb to be, if you give it esse, you actualize that essence because it actually exists now, then you wind up with an ens, which an ens, ENS, is a complete being. It's a being that actually exists and it has a certain nature. So just to, before I hand it over to you, just to like kind of give this an example, you can consider a dog in the abstract, just the idea of a dog. You've seen dogs before, you know what they look like. You don't have to be thinking about a particular dog named Sparky or whatever. You can just imagine dog in general. That's an essentia. That is a form. But then when you encounter a real dog, a physical dog right in front of you that's jumping on you and licking you, that is an ens, ENS, because that has the form of dog. It has that nature, that species. It has that essentia. But it's also actually existing because it's jumping on you and it's licking you. So, yeah, clearly it exists. And so it has the esse joined to the essentia. And then from those two, you get the ens, the particular singular being.
Yeah,
So
so that
I was
word
all
that you
over the
use,
place there.
particular, is really helpful. Or individualize is another word that we used in philosophy. So that an estensia act or individualizes or particularizes being. So to have, there is, let's just say, this isn't correct, but it might be helpful, that being itself or to have existence is floating around up here. And then the thing that is to exist is down at the bottom. And in the middle, that being has to kind of be funneled into that which exists.
That's
And
helpful.
so that essentia is that. It particularizes that there is existence up here to the thing that itself exists.
Yeah, you don't see
And
things walking around without an essence. If in order
yeah,
to
exactly.
exist in the concrete, you have to have some sort of form or essence.
So that we then experience those as two separate things, that you and I share the way we exist the same, the essence is the same, or the substance of humanity, but because it has to be has been particularized to us individually, we don't have the same being itself. We are
In the sense of
separate
essay.
beings. So yeah, we have separate essays. So and another way in English we call this is an act of being. So we all have separate acts of being, or the way in which we actualize our existence is different from one another. The potency to exist is for us all the same because we all have the potency to exist as humans, but when it is actualized in an individual, we all share in it differently. But how does that work? Okay, so, and if some of you are like, what? Going
It would be really
crazy.
helpful if somehow we had a whiteboard. So you know what? Maybe I
Yes.
should invest in a whiteboard for future philosophy things
Whiteboards
because,
would be great. Like Father Moses, that Orthodox
Father
priest
Moses, he's a
who pulls
chat.
up the whiteboard, is like, okay, I love the way he does things. Like, this is this, this is this, this is this, this is this. Boom, done.
He's
Like,
so
no
matter of
facial
fact.
expression changes.
He's hardcore.
So that's some generals, well, or and specifics, but how can we understand that in relation to other things that exist? Because we say God exists and that rocks exist, but they cannot just be, and we're using the word to be, so that's where it's so hard to talk about metaphysics, because you use words that also defining the words you're using. But they can't all be the same, can they? So what's that? How do we approach those things?
Yeah, the way you just said that reminded me of Empire Strikes Back when Yoda is teaching Luke how to use the Force, and he's inviting him to tap into that fundamental essence that unites the rock and the flower and the tree and his own body and Yoda. You know, he kind of gives this vague New Agey idea that they're all sharing the same being. That's actually false because they are all distinguished according to a different essence. A rock is not fundamentally the same thing as a flower, but just with different looks. No, they're fundamentally different. They have different natures. We are not the same thing as a rock, but just with different looks. No, we are actually different. We are different from dogs. We have different essences from cats. We are like everything has a nature. It has a species. It has a form. It has an essence. You might ask why I'm using all these words, because there's a lot of different words that can kind of get across the same idea. So that's something to keep in mind, that we're not some new agey multitudinous expression of one being. Like, that's a bizarre Eastern idea. That's not the case. There are truly different beings. Now, we all have in common with everything currently existing and walking around in the world right now, we have in common with all that we do all exist. But there's actual distinction according to essence, and so there's a different act of being for each one. Now, one thing that's important to point out is that the different essences that we can see in animal life, in vegetable life, even down to rocks and fire and things, they aren't on just some continuous spectrum from like lower to higher. There are actual different steps. So, for example, I am not just a more advanced or more developed ape. Evolutionists might have you believe that. I mean, I do believe to some extent in evolution, but I'm saying extreme atheist evolutionists would basically just promote that we are basically just chimps and our brains function a little bit better, a little faster. But what you should properly believe in light of proper metaphysics is that no, we are on a fundamentally different step of being. We're not just some continuous, kind of vaguely improved version, but on the same spectrum. No, we're actually on a different step. They have the qualities of animal life, they have those functions, their form contains all of those properties. But then a step above that, we have those things, yet we also have rationality, which makes us fundamentally a different species, a different essence. And so, and similarly, if we want to turn this towards God, God is absolutely above us in such a degree that his existence is like the way in which he exists is only analogous to the way we exist. So it's not like, like some might be tempted to believe that from rocks up to God, there's just this continuous flowing spectrum and everything that
It's
exists
just
kind of falls somewhere on there, and we're generally all on the same plane. No, there are distinctions and there are levels. There is a hierarchy, but it's not a hierarchy of continuity where everything flows from one to the other. It's a hierarchy of distinct ranks and orders.
Yeah, and that God is not just on a step so much higher than us. He's not even actually in this realm. Because while, yes, there are steps, a distinction, and use the word properties, that's really important. Every essentia or essence comes with associated properties. So the essence of humanity comes with the It always comes with the property of rationality. Whereas the essentia of a rock never does. It never is like sometimes there isn't. So that's also distinguishing factors, is the properties that are intrinsically associated with it. Now, there are properties that are also associated, like the fact that we have, skin and hair and height and weight, but
Bipeds.
those are changeable within our particular essence. But the fact that we have them all is fundamental.
We
But
just,
go
sorry.
ahead. No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what you acknowledge with the case of humans is what you call a species-making difference. So the species of humanity has this difference that makes us a distinct species, which is, in our case, rationality. And that, real quick, just because you alluded to this early on in the episode, that's one thing that some people get really confused nowadays with the whole identity culture, especially because the pride movement and a lot of the identity confusion has gone well beyond just gender confusion. It's now gone into species confusion, where people say, you know
Yeah,
what, I
the
actually identify
cat.
as a cat. I identify as a dog. Well, no, cats and dogs aren't just more furry versions of humans. They're not just kind of, differing accidentally in some qualities. That's how some people act when they say, like, I'm a dog mom or I'm a cat mom. But that's not actually how it is. They are a fundamentally different species with a different set of properties. They lack the fundamental property that makes a human being a human being. So a human being who is rational cannot be a cat, no matter how badly they want to, because even if you put on like a fur suit, that doesn't mean you can deprive yourself of the property of rationality, which makes you to be a human, which no cat can have. So that's just a tangent, but I think it's
No,
important to
you're
point
right. No, it is. And we're kind of what is put into question in whether it's gender ideology or just completely misunderstanding of what is our essence are those intrinsic properties. Seem to be the kind of things that I can choose to agree that I have or not. That my mind can decide whether these properties are part of me or not. And that in some in some ways actually kind of flows a lot out of Descartes, where he says, I think, therefore I am. That means that my existence is dependent on what I think about, or if I think. Therefore, if I think I'm a cat, yeah, or if I think I don't have to use a toilet like most people would, yeah, or whatever it is, that becomes what is actually real. And yeah, which means that we then, therefore, like an extrapolation of his conclusion, is that my mind or my consciousness actually becomes the act of being, acting upon my own choice of what is my essence, versus that your essence is set and it is applied to you in an act of being by God alone, and you cannot choose it. But anyways, while yes, there are other steps and there's differences, one thing that all of them do have in common, though, which is separate from God, is complexity. So the word complex just means with parts. So we, like I said, have that essence and then that act of being, or that we exist. There's the way we exist, the mode, and then that we do. Those are two separate things. And Nate said, like, let's do some metaphysics math. 1 + 1 = 1. So you have act of being plus your existence equals you as a being, your ends.
So what you're saying, one thing I wanted to point out is that you can clearly distinguish between the essentia and esse, or an ends, because it's not necessary that any particular ends exist, any particular human being, for example, exist for the human race to exist.
Mm-hmm.
The species, yeah, the right form, the nature exists, even if John or Joe or whoever does or does not exist. You see, mm-hmm, that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's because our acts of being, mm-hmm, are distinct from our essence. Mm-hmm. So we are complex. That means we're made up of more than one thing. These things, yeah, are joined together. Versus God, so what you basically just said is that an individual human is not a necessary being. They are not necessary to exist, right, for right, the world. However, why is there existence? Have you ever asked yourself that? Like, why does existence exist?
why is there anything things rather than nothingness?
Yeah. And some people hate that argument. And to those people, I say, you're just not using your brain, but whatever. Why is there existence? Well, there has to be something, someone, some a being, if you want to call it that, that is not complex, that does not have an act of being that is, yeah, then applied to an essence.
Right.
But rather an essence that is its act of being. Yes. So that existence and essence are the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And that is, and therefore, simple. They're not made of parts, but one. And if one, who this being, or God, supreme, whatever you want to call it, because Aristotle didn't necessarily, he kind of called him God, but kind of called it something else, that only that would have the power, because essence is existence, to then apply existence to separate essences. And that is what God is. Simple, because he's not made of complex parts, but whose essence is his very existence. Therefore, you cannot say that there is this spectrum of being in reality, because all of these other things, while they're on steps, are also complex. God is not. God is simple.
Simple.
Which sounds crazy, because God is the hardest thing to understand, and therefore we believe in our minds God is complex. But in a metaphysical language, God is actually entirely simple.
Yeah. Theology is complicated, but God is simple.
Yeah.
Because, that's the thing. And just, again, to bring another visual, because I think it's really helpful with these things to bring in visuals so that we can try to conceptualize a little bit more clearly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The difference between essence, ends, and esse, I think you could picture it with the analogy of making a statue. So you might have a hunk of just rock.
Mm-hmm.
But then in order for that to turn into an existing statue, a statue that really has some shape and exists and that you can point at and admire, some sculptor needs to come and take that kind of raw rock, that unformed rock, and chisel it down, give it form, give it shape, give it an essence, if you will. And now it exists. It has an esse.
As that statue.
As that statue. But again, with God, there's no distinction between his essentia and his esse. He is being itself. That's why he said to Moses, when Moses asked, what shall I call you when that he was asked for your name. He says, I am who am. He's not just saying an epic quote. When I was younger, I heard that reading and I always thought it sounded epic, like, whoa, God, super hardcore. No, he's actually revealing a theological truth that his essence is existence itself. He is being itself. Mm-hmm. And so any being we have is by participation in his being. Any being that plants or animals have is by participation. It's received from God. But God does not receive his being from anywhere. He is his own being.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes him, therefore, the only necessary being.
Right. Right.
All the other ones become unnecessary, but there has to be one from whom existence receives esse.
Yeah.
Who himself is not complex. So, which that becomes really helpful when there are conversations that seem to kind of drag God out of his transcendence.
Yes.
Yes, Jesus came to earth, which when you also think about the metaphysical nature of God, makes the incarnation wildly more insane.
Way more radical. Yeah.
That is true. God did become immanent in Christ, yet remains transcendent in this gap that is not bridgeable by our, you know, effort.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to reduce God to, you know, especially, you know, when people say, sorry to cut you off, but when people say, you know, as it says in the letter of St. John, God is love. Well, then they make this whole thing about, oh, well, then I don't know. I don't want to go into a tangent that I don't necessarily fully have thought out. But the reduction of God to like all these actions of what love is, and therefore, oh, God is in all of that, or a pantheistic approach or panentheistic approach, because those are two different things. Pantheism is that God is everything. Panentheism is that God is in everything. Both of those are to take the transcendent and make it force immanence upon it.
Exactly. I think a lot of us Christians fall into the error of believing that God is basically just a friendly Zeus. Because what did the Greeks and the Romans believe when they believed in Zeus or Jupiter or Mars or any of the gods or Dionysius, whichever god? Those gods were not transcendent.
No,
they were just, they were what we call in metaphysics an ends. Higher. They're a being just like you and me. They just happen to have a whole lot of powers. Like Zeus was a dude just like you and me, but he had lightning bolts he could throw at people, and he was grumpy a lot, and he had a bad temper, and he was super horny. Like, that's basically Zeus. Sometimes I think we treat God as just a very virtuous, holy Zeus in the sense that we think, it's, again, it's understandable because it's hard for us to wrap our minds around God.
Yeah.
But we think of God as basically being this kindly old grandfather, kind of an ENS, an ENS like you and me.
But just super powerful.
But super powerful, right? He's on the same spectrum of being, but he's way up there. He's just really goated. He's really powerful. No, that's not the case. He is being itself. He is transcendent being. He is truth, goodness, and beauty itself. He is his own life. And so he's not just the source of life for all of us. He is, in a sense, his own life source. So, where was I going with this? Just that it's important for us to properly treat God in that way and recognize that when we're approaching things like the incarnation, because if you treat it that way, then you realize the incarnation is radical, like you said. It's not simply some powerful man up there in the clouds who has a big white beard and looks like a nice grandpa somehow coming down and becoming a human being. Because if that happens, then it's just one ends taking on the form of another ends. But no, it's not that. It is being itself taking the form of a particular human being.
Yeah.
Which is mind-blowing. Like being itself, truth, goodness, and transcendent beauty itself, being born, being breastfed, working as a carpenter, suffering, going to parties with his friends, eating food, teaching, preaching, healing and raising the dead, and then dying. This is beauty itself. This is truth, good self, goodness itself. This is life itself dying. It's not just some living guy who is powerful now coming down and suffering death. No, it is life itself undergoing death. We're in Lent right now. We're approaching Good Friday, of course. And it's really important that we understand this, because this is why metaphysics is not just some pointless speculative project. It's actually really helpful for inspiring our devotion, because it helps us to recognize, wow, the incarnation is way more incredible than I thought it was. I didn't appreciate the incarnation until I'd studied some of this stuff. Because when I say we Christians fall into misunderstandings about God, I call myself out first of all.
Yeah,
Because
for
that's
sure.
totally how I believe God was. Like, I knew he didn't have a body, but in some way, from all paintings I've seen of him and stuff, I just had this impression that he was just this powerful man, in a sense, up there in the clouds. And that at some point 2,000 years ago, he came down and became a man who worked down here. But no, that's not what it is. It's not just he beamed down like a character from Star Trek. No, he fundamentally.
Beam me up, Scotty.
Exactly. It is the word, the transcendent word becoming flesh. It is being becoming a particular human.
A being. Yeah, that's
It's
so
crazy.
wild. It's just, ugh, yeah, it's nuts. And okay, so you were also, you connected not only just saying that God is being, but you also said he is truth, he is goodness, and he is beauty itself. And if for all of those OG listeners to the podcast, almost 2.5 years ago at this point,
Yeah.
actually, it is 2.5 years ago. That's
Over
crazy.
2.5 years ago. Yeah.
If you remember, like the first driving force of why we wanted to do it was to bring the realities of truth, goodness, and beauty back into the world, back into our language, back into our experience, because those are our connections to God. Those are avenues by which we have encounter with the divine. Not because there are things he created in order for us to do them, but because they are expressions of who he is. That God is being, and unity is actually part of this, right? We said that God is simple. That means he is united. He is one. Well, what else then flows out of his oneness? That there is singularly something true. There has it, that God exists and that he is simple, that's a truth. And therefore, if there is a truth, just like if there is a being that exists anywhere, that there has to first be truth itself, just like there has to first be being itself. And then the same thing we can extrapolate for both goodness and beauty. And now some people might say, like, well, I feel like there could be way more things that we call transcendentals. And that might be arguable, but
There are.
Aquinas and Aristotle kind of fundamentally focus on those four: truth, goodness, beauty, and unity. And I just was hoping maybe in the last 5-ish minutes, how are those things aspects of God? And I say aspects because that's a misnomer. They're not aspects of God. But again, falling apart of language when we come into the realm of metaphysics.
Well,
But
they're God, like truth and goodness itself are God considered under a certain aspect.
yes, yeah, okay, that's helpful. But so my question is, and how do we use those or our experience of them, or what does it mean to also have them ourselves, but as like touch points to then walk on this way of understanding God as he is, more than just what we believe him to be? If that question makes any sense.
I think so. I think the merit in looking at them is that it opens the door for people who have a variety of different interests or things that might appeal to them to look at God according to different things that might appeal to them. So, truth, goodness, beauty, I kind of see those as different lens through which you can consider being. So, we said God is being itself, but there's all kinds of ways that you can consciously conceptualize being. So, one example, you can consider how being is desirable in itself. It is better to exist than not to exist. We see one symptom of this in that we just have a natural instinct in our lives to preserve our
To
life.
be alive. Yeah.
It's counterintuitive, it's contrary to our nature, even though sometimes we fall into it, to have, say, suicidal thoughts. And according to our nature and according to the natural law, we tend towards preserving our life. So it's better to exist than not to exist, right? That's why we say that being is good. Meaning it is desirable. Good is just another way of saying something is desirable. It's worthy of being wanted for its own sake. So being is better than to be than not to be. That means it is better to exist than not to exist. That means it is good to exist. It is desirable. So you can consider that God is being and being is desirable. It is good. Therefore, God is goodness itself. Because again, he doesn't just have this being or this desirable being, this goodness. By participation, he doesn't have it received from some other being. He has it in its fullness and by himself. So he is goodness itself and the source of all goodness. Every other good thing flows from him. Similarly with truth, truth is another lens under which you can analyze beauty, if you want, or conceptualize beauty. And so what's true, or sorry, I'm tripping.
Conceptualize
Truth
being.
is another way in which you can conceptualize being. And again, just God has being in its fullness, he also has truth in its fullness. So same with beauty, but you can they're all different lenses.
Well, I want to speak maybe into beauty, why that so beauty, at least from what I understand, is the delighting in the goodness of something. So good, something that is good is by its nature desirable. But there is something more than desirable when we have something that is good with us. We also delight in its presence. And so beauty is when we see something beautiful or we call something beautiful, it's because we delight in the goodness that is in that thing. So if we see a sunrise or a sunset, we say it's beautiful. We know that it's a good thing that the sun is rising and setting, but there is more that we experience in it. There's more that our response to is than just, oh, wow, that's a really good thing. I desire to go watch the sunset. Why? Because it's beautiful. So there's good in it that I'm drawn to, but then the good is also what I delight in. So that means that beauty always accompanies goodness. And then if beauty always accompanies goodness, what is that statement that I just said? I'm saying it as an objective fact, which means that there's something true about that. So you have, and that means if that statement, beauty accompanies goodness, and that is true, that those three things, therefore, are always existing
They're
together at the same
united.
time. There's a unity in order, and but they only happen if there is something that is. I can't desire something that is not. I cannot delight in something that is not. And even if people lie to get a certain way because they hope it's better for them, it increases advancement or whatever, there is no way in which causing disorder through lying is good. So therefore,
It's not beautiful.
lack of truth becomes a lack of goodness. It creates disorder, which is by nature not beautiful.
I'm really glad you said that because that actually, it's like we're reading each other's minds right now, dude. You led right into what I wanted to say, which is this kind of metaphysical approach is really helpful for showing us why we want to avoid sin. Because if we misunderstand God, if we think God's just this powerful grandpa up in the clouds, then we think that God's law and God's commands and his will are basically just the arbitrary choices of some old man who's super powerful, but and he's kind, he's a nice guy, but he's just up there arbitrarily making these decrees. But if you realize he is being itself, then his ways of goodness, truth, and beauty, and his commands, his will, are the ways of true being. And following them, living in accordance with his commands and his precepts, is the way to most fully exist. And so sin, failing to live in accordance with God's will, is basically just choosing to exist a little bit less. It's choosing non-being over being. It's choosing evil over goodness, falsehood over truth, and ugliness over beauty. And so even though it can look really appealing, it ultimately just leads towards this palpable sense of lessening, this draining emptying of the self. That's what we call a privation. A privation is a philosophical term that just means a lacking of some good. So, examples: cold is we feel it like a real thing. It's really just the lacking of heat. Darkness seems like a thing. You look at a shadow and point it out. It's really just the lacking, the absence, or the privation of light. Same with sin. Sin seems like a thing. It seems like even an enjoyable thing, like a whole lifestyle. Some people do create an entire lifestyle based on sin, but in reality, if we look at it objectively and metaphysically, we see that it's just the lacking of goodness. It's the lacking of truth. It's the lacking of being. So living a life of sin is basically trying to work your hardest to not exist.
Yeah, dude, that's crazy.
And why would you do that? Exactly. That's why it is opposed to our nature, and it leads us towards misery. That's why, like I'm sure you've experienced this at some moments in your life. I've experienced this at some moments in my life. If I am living a life of sin and I'm making choices on a daily basis that I know are harmful for my spiritual health, pretty soon I feel it on a psychological and emotional level. I feel empty. I feel depressed. I feel bored. I feel lifeless. Like everything good in my life has been sucked out of me. That's because that's what sin does. That is what sin is. It's this lacking of existence. And so when you do it over and over again, you ultimately wind up existing less. That's why hell is the closest we can get to non-existence. It's ultimately that destination of just hanging by a thread of existing. You're there, but you are in the darkness. You're in the emptiness, the privation of everything good.
A lack of God, So therefore a lack of truth, goodness, and beauty.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the catechism says that sin is first and foremost an offense against reason, because it is to act against, you know, reason. And reason would tell us to pursue what is true, what is good, what is beautiful. Right. And then sin is the opposite of that. And I see, that was the 10-minute bell for Vespers, so I got to run. But that Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So he says, I am the truth. So that makes it even, that makes it easy, that one.
From his own mouth.
I see way and light, life, as the way is like the good. You know, I am the good shepherd. He even calls himself that. But I'm the way. So I bring to you what is desirable. Who is desirable? I'm the way to get to what is good. I am good, but I'm also the way to get to heaven, which is good. And then the life. When we live a life that we're happy with, or we live a life of grace, we delight in it. It's beautiful. Yeah. It can have struggle, but there's still joy there. And joy is not an absence of pain or suffering, and it's not actually happiness. Joy is to live in the identity of who we are and to experience that relationship with God delightfully in identity, even if there's all these other things going on. So Jesus calling himself that, he's showing, the way to be is to be with me. So.
Exactly. Yeah, the way to exist most fully is to exist in accordance with God's law and with the love of Christ. So that's why Jesus says, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly, or have it to the full. He wants us to exist. He doesn't want us to be caged in. He wants us to exist fully.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is through a clear conscience, through the joy of the Lord, through this peace that, like you said, comes from an identity in Christ. So.
And he who is I am gave us that existence and then wants us to live that existence most closely drawn to him who is.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly.
Sweet. Well, we hope you enjoyed today's Crash Course in Metaphysics 101. If you didn't get it, leave a comment and we can try to like hash some things out. And if you did, you know, also throw in a comment. We'd love to hear from you and just like, kind of engage in this conversation. You know, also check out some of our other philosophy episodes if you want to. You know, we got some here and here. And just in general, you know, spread the wealth, spread the word about the Benedict Project. As we move forward, that we have other things we're going to explore philosophically, theologically, spiritually. Particularly now that we're in the season of Lent, check out our Stations of the Cross meditation. It's been very moving for a lot of people and had some amazing impact. So maybe this Friday, if you can't get to your church for Stations, do this.
As Mark Wahlberg always says, stay prayed up.
Sweet.
Yeah. Also, drop a comment below about your favorite cereal. I like Frosted Flakes. How about you? Oh.
Sweet. Cinnamon Toast Crunch for me.
Bet. Yeah. Excellent. Everybody should leave a comment about that.
Do it. Yeah. Do the thing.
Exactly.
Signing off for now. I'm Brother Francisco.
I'm Nate.
Have a wonderful day.
Sensational. Peace.